Give me just a moment to get rid of that program and to take you to the second study tonight. What I would like to do at this point for tonight and then tomorrow is now to begin to work through a number of different biblical characters, passages, places. Again, asking that question, what happens if we look at this familiar or in a couple of cases not so familiar story through a different window? Okay? And hopefully it'll touch on some things that are close to your heart. I'm calling this one, and I'll be honest with you. I mean, as you're coming to hear me and for me to share with what, and I hope you feel how the pain in my heart, because I'm describing my journey to you. And well, I had a group of high school kids over here a year ago. And these kids were just broken, because it dawned on so many of them that it hadn't done them any good to believe that the miracle of the feeding of the 4,000 had really happened, because they hadn't changed who they were. And I just plead and pray that that would at least be something that the Spirit of God would share with us. What I wanted to say to you about being your teacher here, I don't really have a set program for this weekend. What I have, I feel like it's a smorgasbord at a restaurant. And I'm going to pick some things that I think will illustrate what I've said to you. But I am open if there's something in particular you're curious about. I can't promise you I have any teaching on it. But if you do, I'm pretty open to say, okay, we'll look at that tomorrow. So feel free if there's something you would say, what happens if you look at that Eastern? Otherwise, I've got some things that I'll choose. I call this next one God's Land. One of the things that surprised me was when I got to Israel, and got, first of all, began to discover that 70% of the land is desert. Now, I don't know how I can teach that in Idaho in a way. But seeing it, you have 6 years between rainfalls or something like that. I don't know exactly. I did start praying for you, by the way, about as soon as I found out I was coming to Twin Falls. Then I started noticing in the paper about your long drought. And it was interesting how the fact I was coming here suddenly made me concerned about you in a way that I had never been before, because Twin Falls, Idaho was just a name on a map. And so I've been praying for you. You can have a good share of the snow we got this winter if you can figure out a way to get it here. Anyway, 70% of Israel is desert. But what I found was, this is the land of Israel. This is the desert of Israel. What I found was that in the Old Testament, God calls Egypt, you see Egypt there at the bottom, Pharaoh's land. Do I have that on a slide? Let me see what's what I've got here a minute. God calls Egypt, no I don't. God calls Egypt Pharaoh's land. Now I know God owns the whole world, but for some reason, Egypt is Pharaoh's land. It's the land of slavery, the land of bondage. Don't go back to Pharaoh's land, he says. That's the land where you're entrapped to your desires, to your slave. He calls the fertile land of Israel. I didn't put that slide in. He calls the promised land your land. I'm going to give it to you. It's your land. And he calls the desert my land. Now that surprised me. I would not have thought that the desert was God's land. I would have thought the Hawaii-like Galilee was God's land, because that's what I like. But he doesn't. He calls the desert my land. Why? Well, the rabbis talk about that frequently. They noticed a couple of things. So just bear with me a minute and walk with me. These three letters, Dalet, Vav, Dalet, Bet, Resh, D-B-R, if you read it from right to left as they do, depending what vowels you put on it, and remember the vowels were not written when the Bible was originally written, only the consonants, can mean several things. That word can mean desert with the right set of vowels. That word can mean to speak. That word can mean holy of holies. That word can also mean leader or to lead. The rabbi said. So if we go to the desert, we can hear God speak. And the farther we get into the desert, the closer we get to Him. Like the Holy of Holies. And after we've been with Him, like Moses, we can lead. Now you can debate that, but I think that's a fascinating study. Isn't that the story of Elijah? He watches lightning come down from heaven at his command, in a sense, or at least in answer to his prayer. He sees the pagan Baal prophets executed. And the very next chapter, he's laying under a tree saying, I want to die. Forget it, didn't work. So God shows up. And God says, Elijah, tell you what, go to Mount Sinai and I'll talk to you. You know how far that is? 240 miles. One way. Don't you lay under a bush and quit. You walk another 240 miles in that incredible heat, and then we'll see. And he gets there, and what happens? What's first? Wind breaks the rocks. Is God in the wind? Then what? Earthquake shakes the mountain. Is God in the earthquake? Then what? Fire comes down on the mountain. Is God in the fire? Why did those three things happen? I love this. I love it because I'm assuming you're an intelligent audience. Really? I know a few people from this area. They're very intelligent, so I'm judging you by them. But seriously, and you're obviously Bible people. I even saw some of you carrying one in. But you don't think this way. You don't think picture. Do you remember the first time the Israelites got to Mount Sinai? What got them out of Egypt? What divided the water? A wind! Then they arrive at the mountain. And what happened to the mountain? An earthquake! And what came down? Fire. Elijah is re-experiencing Sinai. Isn't that cool? That's so powerful to me because it's not just, hey, cool, there was an earthquake, there was fire, there was wind, but God, it's, wow, God is bringing Elijah back and saying, Elijah, do you know who you are? Do you know who I am? But then God speaks. How? We say still small voice. It's a word that's used in the book of Song of Songs to describe the whisper of a lover in bed with his beloved. It's the most intimate speech possible. And it's a whisper. Because when you're that deep in the desert, you don't need fire. And you don't need thunder. And you don't need wind. You can hear God whisper. Isn't that cool? Nod and I'll go on. Okay, so let's go to God's land. See, that's what my high school students do. I get all pumped about this stuff, and finally some kid will say, let's nod, so he goes on. Okay. There are three deserts. Just a short education in desert might be helpful, and let's talk about why can you hear God whisper when you get to the desert. This is the biggest one. This is the Sinai. It's a desert, they say, where you cannot live without help. God's help, even today. I lived for 6 weeks with a family in that desert many years ago. And I can tell you, even though they had lived in that desert as a family for several hundred years, so they claimed at least, They had to get stuff from other places. There was not enough there to keep them alive without some outside help. Then there's this wilderness, which your Bible calls the wilderness of Zin. In Hebrew, you say Tzin. Say Tzin. T-Z. Tzin. Wilderness of Tzin, you could live if you knew what you were doing without outside assistance unless it was a bad year. Then there's the wilderness of the Negev, which is a wilderness where you can live unless it's a really bad drought. That's Abraham's desert. And then a very small desert up here along the Dead Sea, Rift Valley, called the Judah Wilderness. That's David running away from Saul, Jesus being tempted. That desert is as severe as Sinai, but it's very small. So 15 miles and you're out of it. Now, if I drew a circle, and I forgot to put that on my slide, but if you see the laser here, if I draw a circle about this big, that would be about 40 miles in diameter. In their 40 years of wilderness wandering, the Israelites were in that circle 37 years. Now, I don't know how that struck you. That just blew my mind, because I thought they wandered for thousands of miles. Actually, they stay in an area 40 miles. They move 19 times in 40 years after Mount Sinai. Some have suggested it's because none of the men would stop and ask directions. I don't know that that's been verified. But seriously, my point is, to them, that then meant that those desert lessons were very concentrated in a small place. So let's go there and ask ourselves, why would God call the desert my land? We'll cross the Red Sea or the Suez today and go into that desert. Now, the first thing that would strike you, I think, at least it did me, and again, I can't speak for Idaho. I was kind of looking out the plane window today wondering how you were going to take this because it's my first time here. So I don't know. But I look at it, and the first thing that strikes me is it isn't flat. It's incredibly rugged. There isn't a flat place that 100,000 people could camp in anywhere. I had no idea. Second, what struck me is how totally and absolutely barren this place. It's just nothing. And hot, I carry a thermometer. You got a rock like that, don't you, somewhere? I carry a thermometer. This one isn't even marked on the map, and yours is like brochures. I carry a thermometer. I don't think I've ever been in that desert where it wasn't 120 at noon. And that's as high as my thermometer went. It is absolutely in. Look at it. Now, I suddenly thought to myself, I used to get on the Israelites for complaining. But they complained about there's nothing to drink, there's nothing to eat. I never once saw them complain about the dust or the scorpions. Or the heat, or no shade. Man, I'd have been whining about everything. And it struck me how much their struggle was about, I need to stay alive. Now, I'm not suggesting that God liked their complaining. I think we trivialize that complaining into sort of whining that things aren't really nice. When in fact, it has to do with, how are we going to be alive tomorrow? The other thought that struck me is, I have no idea how in the world you lead a group in a place like this. You can't see each other. It's all like this. Those people must have stretched for 100 miles. It's a miracle beyond comprehension that the Israelites were able to survive that long, that much time. But for the Israelites, this is where their faith is born. The rabbis teach Abraham was a desert man. He was the father of the people. Moses was a desert man. He is the father of our faith. David was a desert man. He is the father of our nation. Our whole world was shaped in that desert. So they believe that more than 70%, or some teach, that more than 70% of the biblical images are desert images. So let's look at some. And again, do the Eastern thing. This was the first thing. I've hiked a couple of times from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. There's a debate about what's the real Mount Sinai, but anyway, assume that this is probably in the general area. I tell you, It changed my whole view of what it means to be saved. Because if you ask a Jew, what is salvation? She will say, read the book of Exodus. You will give him a definition, because you're Western. A Jew will tell him a story. If this is what being saved is, please don't walk out of here tonight thinking that once you're saved, things are cool. Sorry about that pun, but that things are everything. If being saved means I got to live in the desert, then it is not going to be easy. It was so radical to me, I don't even know what all it did. But we got to this place. This is a place called Rephidim. If the scientists are correct, they debate, you know, it's all archaeology, but probably is. This is where the Amalekites showed up. You remember the story? Israelites are coming out of Egypt, and the Amalekites, these desert nomads, attacked the rear of the column and began to harass the old and the young and the weak. The rabbis jump all over that, of course, because there's a picture. You can tell, they say, that Israel is immature. Because if they were mature in their faith, the poor wouldn't have been at the end of the line. They'd have been in the middle, protected by the strong. So let me ask you a question. The church you go to, where are the weak in your community? Are they on the fringes? And all the strong form the solid core? Or do we put the weak in the middle? And be an interesting question to discuss as a faith community. Where do we put the weak in our community? Okay. So God says, that's it. Nobody messes with the weak in my people. So God says, go do it. Go deal with them. And I don't understand all the blood of the Old Testament. Somebody will ask me tomorrow, explain that. I struggle with that as much as anybody. But Moses stands there. If he raises his hands, the Israelis win, the Jews win, the Hebrews. If he drops his arms, you remember? So Aaron and Hur stand on either side and hold his arms up. When the battle's done, God said, we haven't got time to finish this now, so go on to the land. But someday, those people will be dealt with. Because my judgment, I'm patient, I'm long-suffering, I think is implied in the passage. Someday. Who gets the job? Who gets the job of dealing with the Amalekites? Thank you. Saul. And what is the king of the Amalekites in Saul's day? Agag. Somebody said it. I heard it. Very good. Agag. Saul from the tribe of Benjamin, from the family of Kish, gets the job. Does he do the job? He doesn't. He doesn't kill everybody. He leaves people alive. Now, again, I don't know the whole thing about God's anger, God's judgment, but I do know he disobeys God. Where does the story pick up? Thank you! Now, there's a man of the text. I'm judging man from the voice, so I hope I didn't offend somebody. Who's the protagonist in the book of Esther? Haman. Haman is a descendant of Agag. Do you realize what Saul's sin did? It almost cost us Jesus. Because Haman got permission to kill every Jew. People talk about sin as being something, well, God forgives. Yes, he does, but sin has consequences. And this came back to roost 500 years after the initial event. And it was that close, humanly speaking, to wiping out God's entire plan. Who saves the day? Give me her Jewish name. Hadassah. Look up sometime what the myrtle tree means in the Old Testament, and you'll see why she was called Hadassah. Ishtar is the pagan goddess of fertility. That's the name the king gave her. Okay. We call her that. That's fine. What tribe is she from? What family? She's a direct descendant of King Saul. Did you know that? God gives Esther, Hadassah, an opportunity to redeem the honor of her family and her clan. This is the first time I have ever taught this in a non-Jewish setting where somebody knew that answer. And it's not that you're biblically washed my tongue this morning, can't do a thing with it. It's not that you're biblically illiterate. It's that we don't read with that same window that they do. Isn't that cool? I love it, at least. Anyway, what would you think is the most dangerous thing in the desert? What kills the most people? Heat. No water. Say scorpions. Oh, they're nasty. I got bit once. It was very embarrassing. I showed up at this Bedouin family, and second day there, I'm, you know, trying to act cool. Because obviously, I know nothing. The sheep all run away, and I pull my hiking boot on, which they thought was so crazy why I would wear these great big hot boots, and I forgot to check. And I took it off in an enormous hurry, and I thought those guys were all going to die laughing. Anyway, the greatest killer in the desert, by far, by 10 times, is floods. Always. Far more people die every year in this desert because of flash floods. Now, it doesn't rain here. Measured rainfall here, nothing on record in the last 800 years. But it rains a considerable distance away, up in the mountains. They're limestone, and you know this living where you do. They cannot absorb the water, so the water goes down to the Rift Valley, down to the Mediterranean, of course, and down south, and goes into the desert and carves these unbelievable flash flood canyons. And you can be standing in one of these canyons, like that one of my students is down there, on a perfectly cloudless day where it hasn't rained in 800 years. And that water will come through there as deep as the ceiling in this auditorium. Just, and anything in there is gone. Shepherds lose their lives regularly. Not the same shepherds, obviously, but lose their lives regularly. That's like I heard on National Public Radio this morning on my way to the airport that every 9 seconds, a woman in Africa gives birth. And I'm thinking to myself, they got to find this woman and stop her. I don't know why I do that to myself. Anyway, seriously, the Bedouin do a thing. They'll hang the end of a barrel on a wire or a chain, and they'll hit it with an iron rod. And you can hear that for miles. And then the shepherds will scramble up out of these canyons. Because if you're in that canyon or this one, when the flood comes, by the time you hear it, you're not going to get out. Now, it is the kind of thing where you can anticipate because there's a rainy season. So right now, I would be really hesitant for me to hike there. Bedouin, no, I wouldn't. But in the summertime, I mean, it doesn't rain in the summer, so you don't have that problem. Now, there are many references in the Bible, so the Jews believe, that draw on that image. For example, the psalmist says, I wait for redemption. Lost my changer here. I wait for just a minute. Does it work now? Is it working? Good. It works. I'll put it on my belt later. I wait for redemption like floods in the desert. Now, at first, when I wrote a paper on that in seminary, and I remember it has to be, I wrote, Jesus' second coming. Because floods in the desert don't happen. I got a good grade on the paper. A Jew would say, no way. That's not the point, because floods in the desert happen all the time. The point is redemption comes with enormous power, suddenly and unexpectedly. So the psalm writer's in trouble, and he's saying, God, save me! Knowing that God can, boom, snatch you out of danger like that. Or how about this one? I've been down this road recently, where that water pools, puddles like this. It leaves behind topsoil that it carried down from the mountains. And that is a gumbo like I certainly have never seen in the Midwest. I've seen before where it'll be in the field, and if there's a sprinkler, I saw a tourist bus drive across a place that had been sprinkled, got maybe 100 yards, and there was so much mud on the wheels, the bus couldn't go anymore. It is the stickiest. What happens is, when that water dries up, sheep or even shepherds will get down in that mud, and they're stuck. And if they're stuck and a flood comes, they're going to die. So David writes, he lifted my feet out of the clay and put them on a rock. And the image is in the desert, there he stands, he's stuck in the mud, disaster is heading right for him, and he can't do anything about it except plead with God. Now, without being too personal, I want you to see where the desert goes. Have you been there? You ever been in a situation that you couldn't change and disaster was bearing down on you and you could watch it come and you couldn't change it? Watched one of your kids walk away from God. That's where I've been in the last 5 years. She's come back. But I stood in that mud pleading with God because I couldn't do anything about my daughter. I even went there one time with a friend, found some mud, and just stood in it because it perfectly described what was happening to my soul. In the desert, you're thrown into situations where the only possible solution is God. And the rabbis say that's why it's God's land. Because he loves it when people have nowhere else to turn but him. And when you're in the promised land, it's very easy to think that my might, my hands have done this. So thanks a lot, I'm doing fine. Here, notice how that plays out. Let me give you another one. And I got to watch my time. Well, this one isn't directly related to that, but I'll come back to that theme in a minute. Where the water goes around a corner like this, it comes from the left. You can see where it came around the left. It wears the limestone. Is this at all like Idaho here? I mean, I don't honestly know. I'm looking at you and you're sitting there. See, you have the you've been practicing so hard, and I appreciate that. You know, you guys have been all your lives practicing the Christian thing. Okay? And you've become masters at it. Here's what you practice. God is awesome. He is stunning. That is amazing. I can't believe how wonderful God is. Man, I love. See, if you're Jewish, you're dancing. Okay, don't dance. Where the water comes around the corner, it wears the limestone. And where the limestone is worn, you get silica sand. Very, very fine white sand. Now, the biblical people did not live by the sea. That was Philistine, or in the New Testament, Greek and Roman. So when they needed sand, they went to the desert. And they looked in the bottom of these canyons called wadis, because that's where you find sand. And you'll notice your Old Testament distinguishes between sand, which they would say is this, and the sand of the seashore. Now, the sand of the seashore, if you look at how the Hebrew is constructed, it means the sand that comes out of the sea. Tell me about if I picked up a handful of this sand in my hands, what's going to happen? Fall through. What happens if I go and take a handful of sand out of the ocean? So what did it mean that Abraham's seed will be like the sand of the seashore? See, a Jew would see not only the number, but would see they're going to be a community. They're going to stick together. Anyway, if you want sand, and sometimes God says you will have descendants like sand, and he doesn't say the sand of the seashore, a Jew would say, that's the desert.
Now, there was a rabbi who told a story. He said there was a nudnik who built his house on the sand. Is sand a bad foundation to build on? Where's the builders here? You'd rather build on sand or clay? It's always sand. It compacts, it drains, it's easy to work with. People, it isn't the sand that's the problem, it's where it is. So if you build your house on the sand, let's see if our little song got it right. The what's Jesus talking about? Somebody built their house in the middle of this canyon. Now, you don't chuckle at that, partly because that's not how you respond religiously, but partly because, well, I think that's so clever of Jesus. It would be like I came here tonight and said to you, I'm going to build a new house, and you're going to be able to see Lake Michigan out of all four sides of my house. Because I'm building on the ice. You would chuckle a little, at least inside. When Jesus said a nudnik built his house on the sand, those people were all chuckling. Because they knew it might be 2 years, might be 5 years, might be 10 years. Okay, anyway, just another desert image. Let me try this one. This is a favorite of mine with students. I like to take people hiking in this desert because by noon, your water's 120 degrees. You know, the kids start out, we always have to have this thing about what's modesty. Because A, you're in Muslim country, and B, my standards of modesty are slightly different than theirs. So they start with as little as they can get by with and be modest. But it's funny to watch because by noon they're putting stuff on. Because they're discovering your body absorbs more heat if it's uncovered than the clothing keeps in. And it's so hot and it's so intense and you're barely making it, especially those of us who come from the Midwest where it's rarely hot like this. And then, in the distance, and there aren't many of these, somebody sees a tree. Now, what's amazing about this tree is that it grows in the middle of the desert. And I mean no water. See, if I see this, and I'm not the world's expert on desert, but I have spent a lot of time there. If I see this, then I say to myself, there's water there. There is no way palm trees grow without some water at the surface. So we know there's water there. There's got to be an oasis. And that's Elim, where the Israelites were, at least probably is Elim, if scholars are correct. But this tree grows where there is no water. They claim the roots go down 500 feet. The tree is called Arara. Say Arara. Spelled like this, Arara. I could find you a dozen of them, but that's about it. They are not very common. But that tree will grow, and it'll be the only living thing you can see for miles. And it doesn't just grow. Look at it. It gets a fruit on it, like a big orange, a small grapefruit. Just absolutely enormous. And not one, but hundreds. It's incredible that that thing can survive in the desert. It's just stunning. So, of course, I love to have students there because adults are a little more laid back. But students will, oh, let's go. Let's find it. Run. Can we have one? Pick one. They're just as juicy. It's unreal. Break it open. And when you break it open, it's empty. There's a small, hard pit, and that's it. It's all air. And there's a white juice that's secreted from those little thread-like things, and that's highly poisonous. So the Bedouins say they put it on their arrowheads for hyenas, or at least they used to before they had guns. There's nothing in it. It's empty. Now listen to the word of God. Cursed is the one who depends on flesh, who trusts in his own strength. He will be like an arara in the desert. He will live in a salt land where no one lives. He will not see prosperity when it comes. So, if I'm doing it in my own strength, because of my wisdom, my training, my power, my wealth, my whatever. I may look like this, but if you broke me open, there'd be nothing inside but death. And then Jeremiah continues. That was Jeremiah 17 that I quoted. Jeremiah continues. But blessed is the man who trusts in God, for he will be like a tree planted by... Okay? And again, you get back to that desert image that the desert always says. It's about total dependence on God. And even those people who appear to be making it, if they're not depending on God... You know, again, without overdoing this, my world is high school kids. I mean, if you took everything away from me in my professional career but told me I could keep one thing, I don't know if I could give up Twin Falls, but if I could keep only one thing, I'd keep my five high school classes. You should see what kids, it's powerful because they get it. It touches them deep. I cannot tell you how many students I've had that have come back and said, that's me. I always have been able to do it without God. That's who I am. Now, I think there's some of us in here who struggle with the same thing, but we're just not as quick or as willing or as capable. Try another one. Oh, let's see. Oh, you'll like this one. Well, I don't know if you will, but I'm telling you, you will. Okay? See the shrubs? This is the shade tree of the desert. I'm not kidding. It's called in Hebrew rotem. Say rotem. In English, we translate it in your English Bible as broom tree. Elijah went out into the desert and laid down under a broom tree. Now, I'm telling you, they do not get much bigger than this. So picture Elijah, and you see how desperate he was. He had his head in the shade, and that's about it. Hagar lays Ishmael under a broom tree, and she walks till she can't hear him cry anymore, and then she lies down under a broom tree. And I'm telling you, I've seen it. The Bedouin girls will have the sheep out in the desert, and it'll get so hot, they're just scorching. They find a place where the sheep can lay against the wall of a canyon, and then she'll go out a little ways because she wants to keep an eye on the goats at least, and she'll lie down with just her head in the shade. And they explain it by saying, I'm not a medical person, so if there's a doctor here, correct me if this is incorrect, but your head is the place where much of the heat of your body is exchanged. So if you can get your head in the shade, you can survive. But if your head is exposed to the heat, you've got potential danger. That's why when you're hiking, the Israelis you meet always will say, get those kids to wear a hat. They've got to have a hat, because if your head overheats, you don't think clearly, you do stupid things. So they'll lay there in that shade. Now, say these words after me. No, before that, let me say something else first. See, the rabbis say that the lesson here is this. Life is a desert. So I would guess many of us for a lot of us. Now say these words after me. The Lord is the shade at my right hand. The sun will not strike you during the day, or the moon at night. Now take your right hand, don't say that, take your right hand and hold it out as far as you can go. God's shade is never farther away than this. He is the shade as far away as your right hand. But notice what he is. See, what I want as a Westerner is for God to say, hey, come to me. I'll drop the temperature to 67. An oak tree will grow with big boughs. There'll be fresh running water like this fountain out here. Often, God says, I'll give you just enough relief of your heat to take one more step.
Been there? If you haven't, you will, if Jesus doesn't come again, because that's life. But God loves it when people say, God, I can't go another step without you. And he's angered, deeply hurt, when we become so self-sufficient we don't feel like we need him. Book of Hosea. Remember how I led you gently into the desert and you loved me. I'll bring you back. Those are scary words. You know what it means to be brought in the desert? It means you're going to hurt deeply. But there'll always be enough shade to make it. Barely. Or this one. Skip that one a minute. When you walk in the desert, this is the Judah desert now, we're leaving the Sinai, but when you walk in the desert, that's the road. Honestly, that's the road that goes from Jericho to Jerusalem. Remember the parable of the Good Samaritan? I doubt you would call that a road, but that's what the road looks like. Let me find another picture of it. But notice the path, always strewn with rocks, stones of stumbling, they're called. So life is a walk in the desert, and on your path and mine are stones. Now we've got a different metaphor, but same point. So you're walking. Right now, some of you here are walking on little stones. Little annoying things that are bugging you, but you can handle it. There are other people here that the stones you've twisted your ankle on and you're hurting. There are some here tonight that have come across a stone that you hit that brought you right down to your knees. And I would guess there are a few here tonight that are standing in front of a rock saying, I can't go around this thing. Say these words after me. If my people would but listen to me, if they would follow me, I would satisfy them with honey from the rock. What is honey? Taste of God. And where do you find the taste of God in life? In the rocks. It doesn't make the rocks hurt any less, the rabbis noted. But every rock you stumble over has a little taste of God in it. Be honest. Think back to those rocks in your past. Would you say that there are times when you knew God the sweetest in the most difficult moments? Maybe later. The rabbis say, be careful when you pray for honey. He may put it in a rock. But it's that same thing. God loves it. My Jewish friends say, you people, talking about Christians, you people misinterpret the Beatitudes. You read the Beatitude, it says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And you take it to mean, when you're mourning, God is going to come along and make it better. And that's the blessing. No! The blessing is that in mourning, you experience the arms of God. Would you rather be deeply hurting in God's arms or feeling fine and having no sense of Him? Or, let me take you to the last one because my time is running. There's got to be some, I'll put this one in here, if there's somebody here like my brother who would like to hang him on the wall. He immediately thinks of what he would do to kill him. I don't understand it. But I keep asking him, why do you hang those things on your wall? Well, they're so beautiful. Hey, my wife is beautiful too, but I don't have her hanging on the wall. I don't have a problem with it.